All right, Project, welcome back to this episode of Throwback Thursday. Today, we are throwing it back to November 2018 with former American gymnast, Olympian, Dave Durante. Dave is from the Monkey Method. That's what we found out since then. And actually, since the recording of this show, I used his app, Core 365, I think. Or that's a core program within the Monkey Method app. And it's basically core training every single day for a year. I did not do that. I think I got 65 days in, and then I started breaking it up a little bit. And then, anyway, the point is, if I'd stuck to it,
you would have hit 1 year about a week ago.
Yeah, it would have been really good because the programming on there is fantastic. There's so much core stuff that you just don't consider that until you have like an expert programming core. Like, you just learn so much. And so, yeah, that was super valuable. And obviously, this podcast was super valuable with him as well. We really enjoyed it. He has so many cool stories of like just being in the Olympics and what it takes to be like a high level gymnast. So yeah, this is a pretty incredible episode.
And what it takes to get a 10-minute freestanding handstand.
Yeah. How he broke down the levels of skills within gymnastics. He's like, yeah, that's a 4-year skill, that's a 10-year skill. Yeah. That's pretty interesting. But anyway, so today, they didn't have recovery bands back then, like they do now. Whoop just actually finished raising $55 million, another seed round. I think that's probably because Google bought Fitbit for $2.1 billion, so obviously there's a huge market for it. And yeah, we've been enjoying the technology. They keep upgrading the technology, which is pretty cool. I don't know if that was a Fitbit thing, but yeah, the technology keeps getting better. So it's awesome to. It's like having a Tesla car, right? Every time you get in, they've like done a new update, and it's a better car than it was last night. And that's what the Whoop band is. It's updating overnight, and every time you get to it, it's a better band. So recently, I've been using the summary of the sleep performance, which has been super helpful to kind of look at the 7-day average, which is better than just looking at the night-to-night average. And there's work to be done. There's things to improve. And I would have never known that. I would have just been like, oh, I'm tired, if it wasn't for, you know, tracking this sort of stuff, which is super important. So whoop.com, use the code MindMuscle when you check out.
15% off.
It's a really good deal. All right, thanks, guys. Let's get into the show. This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Raph Freeman. And you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
The Mind Muscle Project. All right, Mind Muscle Project, welcome back to another episode. Today, we have on Dave Durante. Now, we tried to get Dave on many years ago when we were doing our US podcast tour in 2016. And it is true, he is as jacked on Instagram as he is in real life. So Dave was on the reserve team for the Beijing Gymnastics Olympic team, but he's probably, I mean, that's a great achievement, but what he's most famous for is doing Bring Sally Up, Bring Sally Down with freestanding strict handstand push-ups. That's a real achievement right there. So we're excited to have you on the show, and before I even knew who you were, Dave, I actually was on a ring thing probably, I want to say, like 7 years ago, and it was a very weird experience because not only was CrossFit kind of new 7 years ago, but like I didn't even know a ring thing was like a real thing. I thought it was a joke. Like, so you just I thought someone just bought it at like the supermarket or something, because that's kind of how it looked. But it's actually a pretty amazing training tool. I wanted to know, is there any, like, have you ever seen anyone do some pretty crazy shit on it besides yourself, or is anyone, you got any weird stories of people just doing dumb shit on ring things?
Oh yeah, plenty, absolutely. We definitely try to stress what it's supposed to be used for. It's a product meant to, you know, train people good technique. Basically what our whole motto is and mantra is with Power Monkey, and we see people doing some crazy stuff in there and tagging us on Instagram and trying to do like flipping actions and swinging, doing like full giants, like if you would.
Full giants.
Some of the things are like, I wouldn't even know these things were possible. Like, very cool that you were able to do that, but please don't show anyone else. Because you don't know what
people doing. Yeah, yeah. One question that we asked a fellow Power Monkey coach of yours, Chad, and I think might be a good place to kind of start with this podcast is, Chad obviously was an Olympian as well for American. We kind of talked about the transition that he has had to make from, you know, being a full-time superstar, you know, best Olympic weightlifter in his weight division for the country, and similar circumstance to yourself. How have you found transitioning from all that training, or, you know, all that progression, all that dedication to being a coach and teaching, and kind of
So I don't really know what Chad's answer was with that, and I think everyone finds their own path to the coaching side of things. Mine was kind of unexpected. I wasn't intending to be a coach at all. In fact, when I was done competing, I made a concerted effort to not coach. I had seen kind of my coach, the Olympic Training Center, have such an impact on me, and he was able to do things and pull stuff out of me and the other athletes that were on our team that were really incredible. And I always looked at him as saying, he has something special as a coach that I know I will never have. Like, I just looked at him and like, he was meant to be a coach, and I just don't have that in me. I preferred to be an athlete where I was in control of everything that kind of was in my destiny as an athlete. And so the coaching side was something that I really didn't have too much interest in doing when I was done competing. I liked being an athlete, and that was it. And so when I was done competing, I really wanted to try to move away from the sport, and I moved to Europe. And my intention was to kind of step away and try to find a new path for myself. And fortunately, coaching kind of found me. I got injured while I was in Europe, and I ended up having to have surgery while I was living in Rome. And the surgery kind of brought me back into the gym, and I started coaching at a little local gym, and I really started to enjoy it, and it kind of snowballed into something bigger and bigger. And then from there, I was like, you know what? I actually do enjoy this a lot more. Okay, I think that time off from being able to step away from the gym as an athlete and catch my breath and really start to see how much I really do love the sport brought me back in. And I think that happened a little bit more organically rather than me seeking it out. And I'm really lucky that I did. And I think what's really unique about the path that I've been able to find in terms of coaching is that I love coaching people who are passionate about gymnastics, and that finds different forms. And what's unique about this specific path, and it's new because of, you know, how popular CrossFit has become, and in fact, people are now interested in gymnastics who weren't years ago, is that I'm able to coach people who didn't grow up with gymnastics. And my whole goal is to build gymnastics and the interest level, and to hope that it becomes a bigger and bigger sport, and to show how amazing of a sport it is. But my coaching is done through teaching adults who didn't grow up doing it. And that's a very new path. It's a path that wasn't available to gymnastics coaches even 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago max. And so it's a completely new direction that we get to do and bring new people to gymnastics, and I love that.
Mm. Why did you pick Europe to kind of escape to after gymnastics?
I have dual citizenship with Italy. My parents are from Italy, and I have an Italian passport. I grew up spending my summers in Italy, and I wanted to always connect with that side of my family a little bit more. And while I was training, it was always very difficult for me, you know, to be able to spend time with my family. And there was always a big separation between, you know, the things that you want to do and the things that you're able to do as an athlete. And so when I was done, I thought it was a good opportunity for me to go and connect with that side of my family. And it was an easy fit with most of my family living in Rome at the time. My immediate family, parents and brother and sister, live in New Jersey, but majority of the rest of my family lives in Rome. So it was a nice, easy transition for me.
Mm. Is it hard to know what to do with all your time? Because like gymnastics, you put obviously big hours in that sort of sport. Like, there surely is like a weird empty feeling for a little bit of like, what the hell am I going to do with my days?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. And I think some of it is welcomed because, I mean, personally, I was an athlete that overdid it sometimes with the amount of obsession on some levels, you know, passion to the point of maybe taking it a little bit to an extreme with how much I devoted to the sport. I like purposely went out of my way to kind of, you know, try to shun relationships and make sure that my time was spent as much as possible in the gym so that when I was done, I had no regrets. I always had the mentality that when I was done with the sport, I didn't want to have any regrets. I wanted to leave it all out there so that whether or not I achieved all of my goals, I knew that I gave everything that I had to it. And I wanted to be able to look back 5-10 years, the rest of my life, and say that I could have given something else. So that meant, you know, to be able to do that, I had to, you know, sacrifice a lot of other things. So when it was all done, it went from like, and you see this a lot with elite athletes, not just gymnasts, but our Olympic athletes, you see it in all sports, that when their careers come to an end, there's a void, right? And like, how do you fill that void? You know, you identify as an elite athlete for your entire life. And then it goes from being at the pinnacle of that sport to not having it at all. It's not a weaning off of process. It's not like it hits a peak and then kind of slowly starts to fade. It goes from peak to abyss. It goes to nothing really quickly.
Yeah.
And it can be a little bit difficult to kind of figure that out. So for me, it was welcomed in the sense that it gave me a chance to kind of catch my breath and exhale and figure out kind of a new avenue. But at the same time, it's a little bit scary in terms of figuring out, okay, now what do I do with myself?
Mm. And what year was that? What year was it that it sort of you moved to Rome and stopped competing?
So after the Olympics, I had actually a torn ACL during the Olympics and leading up to it. So as soon as I got back from Beijing, I had knee reconstruction. I have had three over the years. And so I was rehabbing at the Olympic Training Center, and right at that same time, I signed a contract to go and coach my alma mater, Stanford, for a year. And the only reason why I signed that contract, one, because I love Stanford. I feel very fortunate to have been part of that team and still feel really close with the community. But I never won a national championship as an athlete while I was there. Our teams were, you know, fairly mediocre during my time, and I wanted to try and win a national championship with Stanford. And at the time, the team was very, very good, and they had finished second the previous year, and I thought that I could help push them over the edge. And fortunately, we did win a national championship that year. I got my NCAA ring, and the plan was to sign a one-year contract. As soon as the year was over, I was going to move to Italy, and that's what I did. So as soon as my one-year contract was up, I moved to Rome.
We've actually never really experienced this in Australia because gymnastics is, well, our national sports are small, but gymnastics is even smaller.
Yes.
I think I knew one kid growing up that did gymnastics.
And you went out of your way to bully him.
I wouldn't say that, but we got him to do a lot of tricks. We're like, all right, go flip and go walk on your hands. But how did that go? Like, obviously, you chose gymnastics from a very early age, or maybe it wasn't necessarily your choice, but you were doing it from a very, very early age. How did that go growing up as like a, you know, through your teens and like developing into a dude and trying to be masculine, but, you know, also knowing you're not the guy on the football team, you're not the guy playing basketball, you're the guy who's super jacked but does gymnastics?
Yeah, that's actually that's a very good question. And it's something that I think it's one of the reasons why a lot of kids who are even promising in the sport to kind of go on to bigger and better things end up dropping out right around high school level. 14, 15 years old is kind of normally the point where people need to make a decision as to whether or not they want to try to pursue an NCAA scholarship or spend more time with their friends. And it's challenging. In all honesty, it's not an easy path. Being a gymnast growing up, obviously, you know, being in high school and growing up, there's so many petty things that, you know, people get picked on and bullied for that, you know, you do your best to just kind of like stay above it all. And for me, I kind of like bring this up sometimes when I'm having doing a talk or something like that. And there's a friend of mine who's one of my best friends from high school, and it would doing in a very joking manner, but would always constantly rip on me for being a gymnast growing up. And you know, they always understood that I was a pretty good junior level gymnast kind of through high school, but constant you know, getting made fun of and getting picked on. And obviously, as a gymnast, I was, I think, maybe 4'9" in high school. I didn't hit 5 foot till I was in college. But the fact that I was doing gymnastics, the fact that I was like able to be put into a locker, made it very easy for them to actually do that. But for me, I always had kind of humor around it. I would wear shirts to high school that said, like, if gymnastics were easy, they'd call it football. For reasons like that. But I did a ton of sports growing up. You know, my family, we've always been fairly, you know, into athletics and into sports. It's not gymnastics. I'm the only one that was into that. But I played baseball. I played basketball. I played soccer my whole life. I wrestled for a very long time. So I've always been fairly into sports. And gymnastics was the one that, one, stuck with me because I felt like it had the most capability to turn into something bigger. And also, it was the one that was the most challenging. And I felt like was the one that separated me from what everyone else was capable of doing. And this is what I tell kids, too, when they're growing up and being picked on. It's like, you're able to do something that only an infinitely small part of the population can actually do.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're starting to see now is, like, the people that were making fun of me in high school are now doing fitness or in the CrossFit community and calling me and saying like, oh my God, I'm so sorry for doing that. You teach me how to do a muscle up. You know? But it comes back, you know, it comes back. And now you start to recognize, it's so difficult when you're growing up to kind of see that. And and when you're in the moment to recognize that it is something so unique and so cool. It takes, you know, your first keg stand in college for everyone to be like, that's an amazing party trick. Yeah. All those years of training are now worth it. But now that, you know, CrossFit and the fitness community is starting to see that gymnastics is cool, all those years are starting to kind of come back and say, you know what, you guys actually did something cool while you were growing up.
Mm. I'd say Instagram's probably had a bit to help with it as well. People maybe before wouldn't have, you know, they only saw gymnastics when it was like in the full suits at the Olympics, and maybe they weren't even tuning in because maybe the ping pong was on and so they missed it, or they just saw the highlights. But now it's all over Instagram that it's like so popular that people want to do it. People just see it every day and they're like, that's awesome.
And there's like spin-offs like calisthenics and just like kind of like street style gymnastics as well.
Yeah, and the parkour stuff.
You see it all the time now. And for me, that's amazing. It means we have hope. We have hope that our sport is going to grow. And everything that we do with Power Monkey, the whole intention is to get more people to do it, to love it, to do it with good technique, to understand the purpose behind the movement, to understand how to move well, not just do it. And so I love the fact that calisthenics is having a moment right now and the gymnastics is having a moment and people are understanding the benefits, not only to go to the Olympics or become an amazing gymnast or whatever it might be, but just to move better and apply that to whatever else they want to become good at. So for me, I feel like we're really well situated to be at the forefront of good information and good content and good technique. And we want to help facilitate people's growth and be a part of that relationship in terms of their fitness journey.
And just to compare gymnastics to weightlifting, I've always wondered, is gymnastics a sport where, like, if you start it in like a normal country like Australia or America, like a democratic one, and you just start doing it when you're very young in school, like, can you compete against the Chinese kids that are pulled like straight from the womb, straight to the top of the rings, or out of Russia that start when they're like one and always do it? Is it like weightlifting where it's very hard to compete with those countries, or does it turn out that you can?
You mean just at a junior level? Like, are we...
No, like all the way up to the actually getting to the Olympics. Is it possible to compete with the countries that I just imagine put in much more hours at a much earlier age, sometimes not by choice?
So I'd say that there's a handful of countries that have always historically been very strong in gymnastics. China, Japan, Russia have always been very, very strong, have continued to be strong. We had our world championships just 3 weeks ago, and you know, those were the teams that, again, kind of stood out from the rest of the crowd. Russia was a little bit down for the last decade or so, but now is absolutely incredible and is stronger than ever. The U.S. has probably since 2001 is when we kind of had a little bit of a moment moving forward. And the teams previous to that had a real big impact in terms of moving the conversation from, can the U.S. compete for a top eight finish and make it to Olympic team finals, to, you know, contending for a podium spot. And it slowly started to trend upwards with 2004 finishing with a silver medal, and in 2008 a bronze medal that was unexpected. And the teams have always been talent-wise able to compete with the China and the Japan, even though those guys have a lot more resources and a lot more manpower to be able to pull from. So it is a challenge, but we have great coaching in this country. We have great resources as well. It's a completely different model in the U.S., especially from an Olympic standpoint, with, you know, the United States Olympic Committee not being government funded, and one of the only Olympic committees in the world that are not government funded. So our resources are pooled in a much different way than maybe, say, a China or a Russia or Japan. But we do a very good job with the resources that we have and the talent pools that we have. And yeah, I think we are able to compete. It's just the collection of athlete and the collection of talent is much different from country to country.
Yeah. I think what's, well, I sort of got a two-part question coming back to what you were saying with, like, you know, doing it but moving really well when you do it. So we had a discussion, I can't remember who I was with, maybe a few friends, and we were just sort of discussing, oh, you know, if we had kids, what would be like the best foundation for them to do? Like, if you know, you could pick out just a handful of things. Obviously some people might say everything, but you know, obviously there is only so much time you can spend training. And there are a few things that came up, and gymnastics came up, but a few people were like, oh, I probably wouldn't put him in gymnastics. And I thought, oh, well, it's strange. Like, it's such a good foundation. They said, well, only because they've seen so many of their friends grow up to their adulthood with so many injuries from gymnastics, like elite-level gymnastics. Probably not recreational gymnastics, but I don't even know if recreational gymnastics is a thing. It seems like you're either, you know, running around in circles, like walking on the balance beam, or you're like really doing it properly. So is there anything that, well, firstly, like, what would you do for, I don't know if you have kids or if you have kids, what your kind of thoughts are on that? And then secondly, even for yourself, was there anything that you know now, you know, having been around guys like Dan Pope and that you would, or and Dave Tilley, that you would change with your own training if you could do it all over again?
I think it's an important question, and I'm glad you brought up Dan and Dave, because they're an intricate part of this conversation moving forward. The sport of gymnastics, like any sport at a very high level, is going to have a danger component and a potential risk for injury. I'd be hard-pressed to find an elite athlete in any sport that hasn't had some form of injury that's going to, you know, show itself as they get a little bit older down the road. In terms of foundation, though, I would be hard-pressed to find another sport that would be better than gymnastics in terms of building coordination, body awareness, and mobility and stability within movement to be able to allow for an athlete to go on to any other thing and perform at a high level. Mm. Does that mean they need to go to the Olympics? Does that mean they need to perform at a competitive level in gymnastics? Absolutely not. And I think that that's an important distinction. Now, do a lot of gymnasts, you know, end up having injuries? Yes. But like I said, you know, find me a sport where you're going to find a high level athlete without some bumps and bruises along the way, and I would be shocked if you were able to do it. Mm. Now, the part of the conversation that's important moving forward is that, do we have all of the answers in terms of being smart about injury prevention? And I think historically the answer is no. And I think that would be the case for most sports. What we see in gymnastics, and I think this is why Dan and Dave are so important, is we're asking more questions in terms of are we doing certain things within the gymnastics community that are appropriate and correct in terms of movement patterns and preparation for our athletes as they go through their growth spurts and as they're preparing for higher level skills, because it's convention and because it's what's been done from previous generations? Or are we doing those things with the mentality being that this is proper in terms of not only developmental from a skill standpoint, but also from a structural standpoint, and making sure that the athlete is building stability and awareness and preparation for, you know, going through the rigors of a really high level athletic career and making sure they're prepared for it. And I think what Dave Tilley specifically is doing an amazing job with is the fact that he was a higher level gymnast at a collegiate level and has been working with so much at the level of junior gymnastics, both men and women. He's been able to use them as resources in terms of seeing what things work and what things don't work from a medical standpoint. He's been able to kind of create a curriculum and programs based around what's optimal and what science has shown us to be correct in terms of movement patterns for the athletes as they're moving forward. So I think what we're trying to do is create programs that are a little bit more smart and well thought out and incorporating the medical perspective as opposed to just using what has been conventionally used. And I think that's what's going to allow us to prevent and hopefully mitigate any long-term injuries or any really serious injuries that we're seeing on the gymnastics side, and hopefully make those athletes stay around the sport longer, healthier, and as they grow up, you know, able to stay as healthy as possible. So it's not an easy question. I think gymnastics is an incredible foundation for whatever you want to go on to do. Hmm. Is there injuries? Absolutely. But I think that's inherent with any high level sport.
So do you think for yourself, do you think for yourself you would have changed anything major, or do you think it would have just been small differences along the way?
I think one of the main things that from a training perspective, I would have incorporated more leg training into my training plan. And, you know, especially working with Chad and Mike Service and some of our other Olympic weightlifting coaches with Power Monkey, My legs are as strong as they've ever been, even stronger than they were when I was an athlete. And with all of the knee issues that I've had throughout my career, I know that if I would have incorporated some more of the things that they've, you know, taught me over the last, you know, 7-8 years, that it would have had some probably really beneficial impacts in terms of my ability to, you know, prevent injury and be a little bit more stable with my legs. And that's something that I feel like was a missing link in terms of my training that I would have liked to implement. On the other side, I think what you're starting to see a lot more now with the athletes is taking advantage of more nutrition and a more well-rounded approach. And that was happening more towards the end of my career. We didn't have, I mean, it was probably on us too, that we weren't as, you know, on point with it as much as I probably would have liked to, but nutrition and sleep and sports psychology and sports science and taking advantage of becoming more of a well-rounded athlete. And that was happening and made more accessible towards the end of my career. If it would have happened early on in my career, I think I would have been better suited and more prepared in terms of applying a lot of those other things together.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's really like a, sounds like more of a question of how many more resources can we find? How much more money can the sport dig up? Do you think of course it has, but, you know, with the new rise in sort of the popularity of gymnastics, have you seen from your side, or have you heard from your side, there been more money being poured into the gymnastics programs because of the increase in popularity, or is it not seen that yet?
I wouldn't say that it's had the same. Well, USA Gymnastics right now is in a very interesting spot. I don't know how much your listeners are aware of kind of the state of flux that USA Gymnastics is in right now. There's a lot of kind of things going on with the Dr. Nasser situation, who has been just a monster within the sport of USA Gymnastics, and dealing a lot of the ramifications coming with that. And now the USOC kind of coming in recently and trying to completely decertify USA Gymnastics. And so there's a lot of things going on within USA Gymnastics that are making it extra challenging, and rightfully so. We're trying to get the sport to move in a much better direction in terms of athlete wellness and safe sport and those kind of things. So it's a difficult question to answer. I think much more people are interested, and we're seeing a lot more adults wanting to do gymnastics and wanting to put their kids in the sport. At the same time, there's a lot of these other factors that are kind of needing to be sorted out before we can actually move the sport in the direction that we want. And so some other things need to be sorted out before we're really going to see the sport kind of flourish in the way that we know we can.
Mm-hmm. And do you think like the culture of the coaching, because one criticism I always heard was that you'd often like go to gymnastics and it was partly gymnastics training and partly just like punctuality and like just more like kind of very strict coaches and teachers, and that was like my only real memory of gymnastics as well. Whereas like when
did gymnastics,
I did it for a very short period. Didn't carry over.
One day trial.
But I just literally remember like going there and just getting in trouble for everything. Whereas like soccer was somewhere like we could just go have fun, and the coaches were like very relaxed, and no one was talking about, you know, taking it very seriously. So I don't know. Do you think it needs to like chill out a bit in the younger years, just in the way they approach it, and it could be a more just fun sport where like no one really talks about, no one ever told me about the Soccer World Cup when I was going to soccer. Whereas I don't know, with gymnastics, it seems like it's more of a defined path on it.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think that's an important part of the conversation too. One part of it that, you know, it needs to be addressed is that, especially on the women's side, you know, the girls are peaking at 16 years old. So the conversations in terms of going to the Olympics and stuff happen at a younger age because, you know, when they're 8 years old, they're already on track within 4 years to know whether or not they're going to, you know, be on the national team and potentially an Olympic team. So those conversations happen a lot younger on the women's side because of, you know, when people are peaking as opposed to mid-20s, 30s in most sports. I do think that for the longevity of the sport and the athletes and the sanity of the athletes, that it needs to be based around fun and making sure that it's an environment that the athlete enjoys going to and that it's not a chore and that everyone's on the same page with. That doesn't mean that it can't be structured and have discipline and all those things. But if an athlete enjoys going to the gym and spending 2, 3, 4, 5 plus hours a day, they're going to, you know, want to do it at a later, you know, years and years. And want to do it when other people are doing other things and going to their proms and they get to high school. If it's a chore to go to practice every day, it's going to be very, very challenging to want to retain the athlete for long periods of time. It's going to be a very difficult thing to get the most out of that athlete. So for me, looking back, I've had coaches and I've seen two different approaches, right? You have a coach that's extremely positive in their approach and using a lot of a positive reinforcement in terms of getting the most out of that athlete. And then you see a lot of coaches that use negative reinforcement. And over the years, I've learned that in terms of retention, in terms of loving the sport, you can use positive reinforcement and get the same out of the athlete that you can get out of negative reinforcement. And I think that's sometimes missed. I think some people think that negative reinforcement is the way to kind of make sure you lay the hammer down and make sure that the athlete is doing what they're supposed to. And that negative reinforcement can have really significant negative ramifications later on in terms of whether or not that athlete wants to continue. So I'm all about a very, very positive approach to coaching, to dealing with athletes, to figuring out solutions in the gym. And I think that coaches would be better suited to figure out that type of approach. I think it lends itself to a much more fun atmosphere that can still be very disciplined, but it's going to lead to athletes wanting to stay in sport a lot longer.
Mm. We, it's along the lines of, a kid starting versus a teenager starting and that sort of thing. We actually had on, I'm just looking at it now, episode 49, which was fucking, feels like forever ago, but also doesn't. Two guys that, interestingly, started their gymnastics journey in their 20s. So before that, they literally almost did nothing. Like, they didn't really have any gym experience.
I think they played video games at quite a decent level.
Yeah.
No, I'm serious, yeah.
quite a high level of esports. And he was 6'1", so, like, really not made for gymnastics, quite tall and gangly. And he's basically dedicated himself since probably the last 6 or 7 years doing gymnastics. And it's actually been pretty incredible because, you know, most of the really good, you know, adaptations, the really, like, long-term adaptations happen when you're quite young, right, with anything that you do. And so, obviously, the 5 years you put in from 7 to 12 is more effective than the 5 years you put in from 21 to 26. It just is. But he's managed to get himself to quite a high level. Now, it's not, it's not the level that, you know, you'd be competing in the Olympics, but he's, like, a level... He's doing all kinds of crazy shit on the rings, you know, iron crosses and handstands and flips and somersaults and all the routines and stuff. And I think it's a testament just to show, like, how effective gymnastics training can be. But obviously, it does require a lot of work. But have you seen in any cases like this people that have started super late that have got themselves to a super high level with, without sacrificing their entire life? Because obviously in your 20s, you have a career and you have other stuff going on. You can't train all hours every day. It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, to me, those are special cases and they need to be highlighted.
Mm.
I love hearing those things. It gives everyone on this journey hope that they can do and follow in the same footsteps.
Yeah.
Especially for someone that didn't grow up with it, that body type is completely against what you would normally think of what a gymnast should look like, and they're going on to do incredible things. Mm. I love hearing those stories. I think we need more of them. The important part, and what he's probably preaching if he's talking about his journey, is one, having consistency and understanding how important it is to be training on a very regular basis, and two, understanding the importance of technique and having a coach or a training method that allows for proper progression, and to understand that gymnastics is about baby steps. It's about incremental gains over long periods of time. I always like to mention just a little bit of perspective in terms of what happens in the artistic gymnastics world. So normally when we're working with people, they're trying to achieve something like a muscle up. And in the gymnastics world, we have skills across the board that are rated from on a letter scale, from an A all the way up to H and soon to be I level skills. And more basic level A level skills all the way up to really advanced level skills later in the alphabet. And most people who are coming from scratch are trying to learn something like a muscle up. And on our scale, a muscle up doesn't even fall. A strict muscle up is not even an A. It has no value. And I tell people this more, like I said, for perspective purposes, to understand how long it takes to learn these movements. I tell them an iron cross on rings, which most people would look at as incredibly difficult skill. I ask them, you know, where do you think a muscle up would fall from an A level skill all the way up to an H and I level skill? Where do you guys? I don't know if you know exactly, but
iron cross.
Where do you think a muscle?
Iron cross. I'm gonna say like maybe a
F. I'm gonna go F.
Maybe a D. I'm gonna say D.
It's a B.
Fuck.
It's a B level movement.
Jesus. Right?
Now, when I tell people that, it's very demoralizing. Like, I'm spending my whole life trying to get a B level movement, right?
Mm.
But it's about understanding timelines, right? I didn't learn an iron cross until my sophomore year in college, and I had been doing gymnastics 12 years at that point.
Wow.
The timelines that we talk about are not measured in days and weeks, which I think a lot of people anticipate the movements taking them to learn. They're measured in months, years, and sometimes decades.
Mm.
And I think that's critical. It's really, really important. And if your goal is to become a better mover and to learn some of these things, that guy that you were just mentioning probably understands that path.
Mm.
He probably understands kind of what it takes to put in the time and have the consistency and the correct training plan to allow for that development to happen. Can it happen to anyone, even if it happens later on in their careers or later on in life when they start from zero? Absolutely, yes. You need to have your goals, have an understanding of what that list of goals looks like, have the correct training plan, and have to have the consistency. Those things will allow you to achieve those things. So I love hearing those stories. It's just about making sure that people understand how long it takes to actually achieve them.
So I don't know if you can see this very well, Dave. This is him. Yeah, this is him.
What level
so
is that?
He's 6'1", and I think at this point he's probably been going for like 5 or 6 years. Has he got any A's in there?
Awesome. Yeah, there's a couple A's. And to be honest, that's incredibly impressive. Now, I always get the question, you know, you see a lot of CrossFit athletes now competing in weightlifting at the Olympic Games and at World Championships and putting up, weights that are competitive at the world level. Will we ever see that on the gymnastics side? Most likely not, just because development in the gymnastics takes so long. Which you just showed me there, that guy learning 5-6 years of gymnastics, what he's doing is incredibly impressive. And I can't state that enough in terms of what he's doing. I have a hard time believing many people will be able to achieve what he's been able to do in that short amount of time, especially with his body type and starting from zero. But what he's doing is something that most 8 to 10-year-olds are doing.
Mm.
And so in terms of it equating to higher level gymnastics, there are still so many levels to be able to get to a level where someone's competing at a collegiate level, a world level, an Olympic level, an elite level, that it's a little bit different in terms of what we're going to be able to see versus what we see on the Olympic weightlifting side.
Mm.
But nothing to take away from what that guy's doing. It's incredibly important, and more people need to see it.
Yeah, it's definitely a good perspective. Mm. I think what has always been interesting to me about gymnastics is that from like a obviously the most attractive thing, or the thing that gets most people into training is they want to look better. They want to like obviously get leaner and feel better about themselves and be more confident. They don't say necessarily, oh, I want to get into training because I want to do a pull-up. I'm not doubting that there's some people out there that want to do that, but for the vast majority of people, even for ourselves, getting into training was about looking better. Gymnastics has always been that sport that you could say, you know, off the top of your head, who are the best looking athletes in the world? You know, people want to look like gymnasts. They want to have arms like gymnasts, that sort of thing. Did you ever consider that, you know, like that, I've been doing this high level gymnastics, but now I look better than everyone else basically that I'm friends with or everyone else that I know growing up, except maybe for the exception of maybe some football players or some other freak athletes or whatever, without really having to, put much thought into it, to like have to know, oh yeah, you know, I started counting my macros and then, you know, I did this split body routine. Like, you just were doing gymnastics and it just turned out you were in a sport instead of like tennis, or for example, that you're just super jacked, right? And now you just basically, I'm sure you've experienced this, you're in a fortunate position where honestly staying in as good of a shape or staying in the tip of the spear in terms of how good you look is quite easy for you, just because that's just the homeostasis. It's just what your body knows. Has it been something that, you know, you've given much thought to over time as to that position?
It's the one benefit of being a gymnast.
Yeah.
Growing up and, you know, being short in stature, very hobbit-like, and all the negatives that come along with that. Having the body type that comes along with gymnastics is one of the, you know, the things that's awesome and a benefit, but it's not something we seek out, right? It's not something that we are doing gymnastics because it, you know, creates a huge bicep or, you know, six-pack abs or whatever it might be. It has a function to it. You know, it serves us a purpose in terms of being able to do things from a physical perspective. Not to say that it isn't very beneficial, and I think it's one of the things that drives people to gymnastics is because they want to look like gymnasts. So
yeah.
I think it's a very fortunate kind of byproduct of gymnastics, and it allows people to say, wow, like, look at some of the things that those guys are doing. Not only is it impressive from a physical standpoint in terms of the skills that they're doing, but also it's creating a body type that I want to try to strive towards. So I think it kind of has like a dual purpose, you know, whether or not, you know, an iron cross is your goal, at least the journey to getting there is going to make you look good, feel better, and, you know, more comfortable taking your shirt off at the beach kind of situation.
Yeah, it was sort of my follow-up is like, I think what people have started to realize is, oh, if I can do cool training and look good, they're not separate things anymore. Like, I don't have to train like a bodybuilder to look good. I can go to the park and do pull-ups and push-ups and handstands, and I can still work towards my goal of looking good, which is basically what we, I don't know if you've been to the Bondi bars in Sydney, but I was there on, it's kind of quite a famous sort of like old school calisthenics spot, which has gained a lot of popularity. But a lot of people are like now trading the gym for an outdoor gym, especially in a country like Australia where it's a lot warmer year round. You know, they're doing their full proper routines. Like, these guys are not just there showing off. Like, I watch them do it. You know, the sun's setting, it's getting colder, and they're out there and they got chalk and they're doing like sets and reps and they're timing their rest periods, and, you know, they've got weights and they're doing, you know, rotator cuff warm-ups and all this sort of stuff. Like, it's become like, you know, a proper way for people to get into training, which I think is really good. I think it's good. It's a good change.
I completely agree with you. It's very exciting for me. I think we're in an exciting time in the bodyweight gymnastics world to facilitate that growth. And I think it's incredibly cool to see. And being in New York City too, you know, Bar Stars is here, and I'm always following them. And we've been talking for a long time to try to kind of link up with them and do some more stuff where we take the artistic gymnastics world and kind of, you know, put some challenges together with the calisthenics world and see, you know, what those incredibly strong and incredibly impressive athletes are doing and how we can kind of build and share ideas. And I'm all about trying to build understanding and technique and growth within our sport. So for me to, you know, hear that same thing is happening in Australia, and us being in Europe this past weekend, seeing the same thing, how movement has taken such a gigantic leap forward in terms of people's approach to fitness, I think it's happening everywhere. I don't think it's happening in pockets. I think it's happening more and more. I think there's a variety of reasons why. I think people are seeing the benefits. I think their social media has completely changed the game in terms of availability to information and techniques and stuff like that. But also the growth of CrossFit has been incredibly beneficial in terms of having people have access to gyms that have rings and handstands and bars and that kind of stuff on a regular basis. So it's been kind of a culmination of a few different things that have allowed for the growth of bodyweight training, calisthenics, gymnastics to kind of get to the point where it is. And I'm hoping that it continues to grow. And we want to be, with Power Monkey, kind of continuing to make sure that we're a resource for people to move back. And that's really our goal. We don't want people just to move and like get a particular skill and be okay with it. We want them to move, understand why they're moving a particular way, understand what their limitations are, understand what the homework is that goes along with them being able to kind of fix those limitations. And we want to make it fun for people. We want to make sure that it's fun so that they want to continue to do it when they get into the 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond, and not to think that gymnastics is just a young man's game.
There's a we had a recent coach on, and he said something interesting, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on it. But he was basically saying that with certain movements, mainly foundational stuff, so let's say, for example, like a hollow rock, probably one of the or hollow hold, one of the most foundational core elements of gymnastics. He was saying that, you know, at a certain point, training that movement heavily has diminishing returns. And so really, once you get it to a point where it's satisfactory, you can move on and not really have to touch on it again, because now it's going to build itself into all the other things, all the other components of training that you do. And it's no longer like a weak link necessarily. Then I also think about, well, I thought specifically for this movement, you always see gymnasts start with a lot of core training and V-snaps and hollow rocks and that sort of thing. But, and then I'm just thinking, well, maybe they're just doing, they're just warming up. Maybe it's like, it's nothing. On the threshold of like using that kind of movement to progress it, it's like nowhere near enough. It's just, you know, a warm up.
It's like leg swings.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that kind of, how much truth do you feel like there is to that with gymnastics? You know, getting good at a foundation movement, they're not really having to do it anymore after that.
Okay, so first I would say on the core side is a strong core, in my estimation, leads to strong movement. And I think that core work, and not just the hollow body position, but really everything that encompasses your midline in terms of core perspective, is something that needs to be worked on every day. Does that mean you need to be doing hollow every day? No, but I think you need to be working on your obliques and your hip flexors and your abs, as well as your posterior chain. I think if you can get that strong, it allows you to move your body much more seamlessly. So I think when you see gymnasts doing the ups and whatever else as part of their warm-up, yes, it's preparation for what they're going to be doing, but it's also reinforcing the positions that they've built strength around. I think positional awareness is maybe where that conversation is what that coach was kind of saying. Once you understand what the position of a hollow is supposed to feel like and how you apply it to a particular movement, maybe you don't have to spend as much time analyzing how to get your body into that position. Now, that takes a long time. That takes a very, very long time. Like, can you do a hollow down on the ground? Can you do a hollow at an angle before you can apply that hollow into a handstand and then that hollow into a dynamic action? So once you have the positional awareness of a hollow position, you can start to apply it naturally to more advanced positions. Now, in my mind, you never stop building those things from a strength perspective. You are constantly working on them. I think if you go to any gymnastics gym, you're going to see athletes maybe perform a perfect dip, but they're going to be continuing to work on the strength of the dip and the strength of their pull and a lot of those foundational movements. Even when they're moving well, it doesn't mean that they stop doing them. So I think the conversation has to do more with building positional awareness and having that become a natural part of kind of how you move, and your body just will naturally go to those positions. But in terms of building strength within that position, it's an ongoing process. I've never seen an athlete kind of say, okay, I got a hollow, I'm not going to really work on that position anymore. You're always going to see athletes working on it. You're always going to see them trying to reinforce the position so that they can start to utilize it at a higher level as the skill requires.
It's interesting. Makes sense. You're trying to do, if people don't know, you're trying to do a 10-minute freestanding handstand hold. I've been following a little bit of the attempts. Can you tell us what happens around like the time when you fall? Because obviously I have no experience being upside down for that amount of time, let alone holding.
Even on my feet for 10 minutes gets sore.
Exactly. I can't even stand on the spot for 10 minutes. So like what starts to fail? Like what? Obviously, at first, it feels easy, and then, like, oh, can you just walk us through that 10 minutes?
Yeah, sure. There's a whole process to it in terms of how I approach it. So just in general, I look at handstands as having three different components to a handstand, and I think most people miss out on some of them. I look at handstands as being a triumvirate, where strength is an important component, position is an important component, and stability is an important component. And all of those need to be worked on together to be able to be on your hands as comfortably as you are on your feet. Now, when I'm doing the goal of a long hold, there's a very specific purpose to it. Now, position kind of goes out the window when I'm just working on an extremely long hold. So if someone looks at my max hold times, it's going to look very different than when I'm doing a handstand for 10, 15, 30 seconds in terms of focusing on position. That's really important to note. And if you just look at me doing a long hold, it's about just maximizing the strength component. I will do really long holds up against the wall to build that strength. I'll do 15, 20, sometimes 30-minute holds up against the wall as part of the training.
Oh, my. 30 minutes?
Jesus.
Jesus,
we
man.
We watched a Netflix episode Upside Down.
Oh, my God.
It gets a little bit difficult, obviously, from a strength perspective. Breathing patterns. breathing is absolutely critical. It's one of the things that people forget when they're learning a handstand, and that's why their hold times are normally fairly short, 10 to 15 to 20 seconds max, because they're holding their breath and they come down and I can't stay up there any longer because I can't hold my breath for that much. So you have to learn how to control your breath. And the goal is to find a breathing pattern that simulates and acts in the exact same breathing pattern as you would do when you're upright. So whether that's in through the nose, out through the mouth, in through the nose, out through the nose, whatever's comfortable for you is kind of what I recommend. But as I start to fatigue, in through the nose, out through the mouth, creating a nice consistent pattern is what I try to do. Now, what fatigues? There's two things that fatigue, depending on where I am and you know how fatigued I am prior to an attempt. My shoulders, absolutely, will be, especially anterior part of the delt, will fatigue very quickly, as you would anticipate, being one of the major muscle groups involved with a handstand. And forearms. Forearms, if my stability is off, which is rare, stability is actually one of the things that is fine. It will normally be primarily coming from the shoulder as the first thing that fails, and then secondarily it will be forearms. And if my stability is on point, the forearms are not worked on until I hit probably the 5-6 minute mark, and then they start to kind of go out little by little from there. But I have a whole rhythm in terms of how I approach every minute of the handstand. And the first 3 minutes, I don't move. I try just to stay in one place, and I try just to have a nice breathing, nice consistent breathing pattern. From minute 3 to 4, I shift my weight every 15 seconds to the right, to the center, to the left. Right, center, left, where I do 10 seconds on the right arm, 5 seconds back to center, 10 seconds on the left. And I'll do that for the full minute to give each shoulder a little bit of a break and spending more time just on one arm. From minute 4 to 5, I'll break my body position and shift the weight from anterior delt more to actually lower back. And it's a really poor position. So if you ever look at my hold from minute 4 to 5, the position will look really terrible.
Is it like the CrossFit position?
Like what?
Is it like the CrossFit position?
Yeah, it's like a banana? An old school position. I always say it's an old school position where, you know, there's a scorpion in my the lower back position.
Yeah.
Not
cool.
But it's done for a specific purpose.
Yep.
And then from minute 5 to 6, I'll start doing the shifts again, but spinning it up into 5-second patterns. And then from there, I actually start switching the weight from finger to finger just to kind of give my forearms a little bit of a break. It's a very specific pattern that I've built to be able to kind of get to that point. From 7 minutes on, it's hang on for dear life. It's whatever I need to do to not fail. It's brutal. It's every second feels like an hour at that point. It feels extremely long. I've gotten to my max time, which is fairly recent. Within the last couple of months, I got 8 minutes and 32 seconds, which was a big PR for me. Up to that point, I'd only gone to 8 minutes twice before, so a 32-second jump was significant. At that point, every second is a big jump, so 32 seconds was a really big jump for me. But I'd like to do it before I'm 40. So I have a year and a half left to be able to do it before I hit that 40 mark. So I'm training pretty consistently to try to do it, but who knows? It's definitely a lofty goal.
So it seems like it's one of those things where like you're doing all the training and you just don't know the day it's going to come. Like you're not necessarily feeling it or not.
That's
it's
how
just
I feel about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm going to what I haven't done is build a really in-depth plan of training specifically for it. Like I'll do long holds every day and you know, I'll work on my handstands pretty consistently, but I haven't created an actual plan to try to get it in place. And I think that's just, you know, me being somewhat lazy with it and having other things that are priority in terms of where I need to spend my time. But I think I'm going to try to create a little bit more definitive plan based around trying to split my time up. I noticed that I hold my best times after taking about a week off and allowing my shoulders and forearms some rest. I noticed that I actually do really long holds after flights where maybe I'm really relaxed and I get off the plane and I haven't used my arms or anything and I get into the gym and I normally do really long holds. It's very strange sometimes in terms of what allows me to do long holds, but I've noticed that the rest is as important as the training when it comes to me being able to hold a long time.
That'll be cool. That'll be a great day when you achieve that.
It's going to be similar to like in cricket when you get to like in the 90s, when you hit that like 9 minutes to 10 minutes, every second's going to be crazy.
Yes. Yeah. That'd be interesting. I did one of your core challenges recently, the It was like the Russian twist, basically the really fast Russian twist. My obliques, like 48 hours later, I could not turn. I could not move because my obliques were so sore. You just coming up all these random things. Is this just like your, like that people can follow on your Instagram, which I think is, the Power Monkey guys are rare in terms of, they actually put valuable stuff on the Instagram. It's just not shirtless photos and useless stuff.
There's a few shirtless photos in there.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, that's just to remind people who's the boss. But, no, there's some cool stuff in there that you can do quite easily. Are you, like, making a conscious effort there? Like, are you Power Monkey guys teaming up? Like, all right, what cool shit or what dumb shit are we going to make people try and do today? Or is it just kind of...
Yeah. I do that pretty often. You know, I try to put up stuff on social media that I see that people are interested in. And there's kind of a few categories of it. You know, people really like interesting handstand shots for whatever reason, you know, around the world. They love challenges. They love challenges that you can do without much equipment that can be scalable for anyone from every level, that aren't over the top difficult. I think sometimes we have a tendency to want to show off and be like, look how amazing I am at this particular movement.
Mm.
But in terms of it resonating with people and wanting to participate and be a part of the conversation, the challenges are normally scalable, and you know, anyone at any level can at least give it a try. And that's what I try to do. And you know, you can kind of scale it up and make it as difficult as you need. But I want more people to be interested. And the reason why I make core such a an emphasis is that I think it's such an important strength that needs to be done on a regular basis that will allow people to move better. So that's why we have our core 365 plan through our app, and just making sure that people are aware that every day they should be doing something built around, you know, a stronger core, and hopefully the challenges are a way to make it fun.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. They are good fun. We've got a bunch of questions that we've lined up for you at the end, the final four questions. I don't know how much prep you've done for them, but Raf, is there any final like handstand myths that you want busted before we jump into them?
Not really. Just because you mentioned it, is core 365, is that just like a core workout every single day? It's kind of like the mobility WOD thing?
Yeah, every day. It's between 3 and 10 to 12 minutes of core. It's fairly random. It's not meant to destroy you. Some of the workouts are pretty challenging, I'd say, but for the most part, it's more having an awareness of doing it every day. It can be applied to any workout and just kind of used as an accessory piece prior or after a workout on a daily basis. It's more with the intention of staying every day. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on core work, whether that be, like I said, abs, hip flexors, obliques, posterior chain, whatever it might be, just so that I can start getting into a rhythm of every day spending a little bit of time into it. So it's with the mentality of saying that a strong core leads to strong movement.
And do you think core is unique in the fact that I find with most people, as soon as they start trying to do anything every day, like something, they get like, oh man, I'm really getting my handstands, I'll do it every day. Like they get an injury pretty quickly, or like with their pull-ups. Do you find core is unique that if people just get into doing like good core work, you don't really get injured from chucking in extra core work?
Well, I think one of it is the variation of it. That's why we try to split it up and not make it every day you're doing abs or every day you're doing obliques. It's varied enough that you're touching different portions of the core sporadically throughout the week, which kind of gives you enough time to rest and recover. And also, you know, with the mentality being that you don't need to crush yourself every single day. You're doing enough to be able to kind of get engaged, build some positional awareness around different aspects of the core, and then, you know, sporadically you can kind of push it to the next level. But I think because you can vary it up and because you can do it in a level that's manageable, it allows you to kind of stay away from any overtraining that might happen in some other areas.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, I think I want to get on that. I need to do some sort of core thing every day, but I just run out of ideas. And then I'm on Dave's Instagram looking for core stuff and regretting it 2 days later when I'm completely maxed out my obliques.
A couple coming up in the next few days that are going to be pretty brutal. So.
All right. I'll make sure I do them. All right, cool. So, Dave, first question that we have for our guests is, if you had an opportunity today to sit down and interview anyone that is alive, who would you interview and why?
Interesting. I mean, the people that I really looked up to in the sport world, I always loved Michael Jordan growing up, to be honest with you. And the reason why, I guess now it's a little bit less important for me, not being a competitive athlete, but I was always fascinated with his mental edge and his ability to compete at a high level when it counted more than and better than anyone else. And for me as an athlete, I always wanted to have that ability to do the same thing. And I was always fascinated, and I loved Michael Jordan growing up, and to be able to kind of discuss those things and what went through his head when everything was on the line, and for him to be able to be at his best when things counted the most, I would love to hear him go through that, you know, that mental side of being an elite athlete. And it was always something that fascinated me from an athlete perspective. And for as much as training is a physical sport, it's as much, if not more, mental side. And he epitomized that. And so I was fascinated by Michael Jordan's ability to compete at a very high level when it counted. And so he would be someone that I probably want to sit down and have a chat with.
Mm. Yeah, you can almost measure his success by the amount of quotes that people still use or put on shirts or have by him. And plus, obviously, the Jordan shoe legacy is going to be a big one as well.
I love him, man. I love him. I think he's an icon, and I just feel fortunate to have grown up watching him play.
Do you collect Jordans like in his honor?
I did when I was younger. When I was growing up, I was just a huge Chicago Bulls fan. I knew I grew up in New Jersey, and you know, I was a Nets fan as well. But the Bulls were like, you know, unbelievable growing up, and
yeah.
I do not love Jordan. So I used to have a bunch of Jordans growing up, but I was the kind of kid that like had to like keep them pristine. I like never wore them. I would just like keep them in the box, and they were like perfect. So I know that they're probably worth a ton of money, but I don't know where my mom, you know, has them or if they're anywhere. But I definitely had a few of the original Jordans back in the day, probably still in the box somewhere.
Shit, man, you should sell those. Should 100% sell those. That'd be worth a lot. Maybe they'll help you get the handstand goal. Is there any like just coming back to that 10-minute handstand? Is there any like particular clothing or pants that you have to wear to get them?
Like very light ones.
Yeah, like is obviously shoes no good. Obviously won't wear a shirt.
Actually, I'm planning on doing a little post on this, and it's I don't know, a pet peeve, I guess you would say. One least amount of clothes possible. So I normally have just like a pair of shorts on, and that's it. I think any extra weight is a disadvantage when you're trying to do a long hold.
Yeah.
But I have a really big pet peeve when people are working on handstands and they have their shoes on. I can't stand it. Mm. I don't know what it is, but I don't think people understand how much more difficult it is to learn proper position and balance, and what we talk about is stability, with shoes on. It might not seem like it's an extreme amount of weight, but when it's at the end of your lever, it's going to make things extraordinarily more difficult than it needs to be. So if you're in the learning phase of trying to work on handstands and positional work, take your shoes off.
Mm.
It's going to make everything easier. It's going to give you much better awareness in terms of what your body's doing. If you're going to be applying handstands to a WOD or to a workout where you're going to be doing other movements, that's later down the road. When you're learning, take your shoes off. I guarantee it's going to help the handstand.
Mm-hmm.
That puts some cracks into the Air Jordan theory.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true.
Just wearing Air Jordans for your handstand. I feel like they're like the heaviest shoes you could wear.
I don't think it's going to help.
Okay, so Dave, the second question we have is there anything that you do every single day that you feel like is essential to the success of the day? Some kind of routine or habit or food or anything?
Yeah, so coming back to Power Monkey again, we have a four-phase hierarchy that we think everybody needs to go through in terms of learning gymnastics movements. And the first phase of our hierarchy is the creation of correct body shapes. You have to be able to create correct body shapes to be able to apply them to higher level movements. Now, creation of correct body shapes, we break down into two subcomponents. One, more core work, something we've already discussed. I want people to be working on core work every single day. That's why we created 365, things like that. If they have a strong core, they can help create the correct body shapes. Secondary component to that creation of body shapes is more mobility. You need to be able to be mobile enough to get your body into positions correctly, or else compensations will happen once you start applying those positions to higher level skills. If those compensations, you know, are extreme, they will lead to obviously less efficient movement, but also potential injury. So if you are mobile enough to be able to create a correct body position and you have a strong core, you will be able to apply it to higher level gymnastics or anything else you want to do. So my recommendation on a daily basis, more core work, more mobility, it will help everything you go on to do later on.
What do you think the minimum amount you could do every day and still make progress is in terms of time?
Yeah, I think 15 minutes is a good number to shoot for.
It's doable.
I mean, that's not what's that?
I said that's doable. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think it needs to be an extraordinary amount of time. I think you need to be warmed up. I think you need to be focused. You need to be using those 15 minutes properly. And it has to be structured. But I think 15 minutes is a completely appropriate and fair amount of time to be able to use the time appropriately and get the most out of it, maximize it.
That's cool.
Nice. Nice. I think a lot of people just started nodding their heads, subtly just going, yep, I can do that. I can
just
do that.
Getting down on the floor for their holler holds.
Yeah, that's right. Third question, Dave, is there anything recently that you have changed your mind on that for a long time was held as a strong belief of yours?
Yeah, absolutely. And this comes along with some of the conversation we were having from earlier. Coming back to what we've done in the conventional gymnastics world, and now what we're seeing some of the information coming back from the medical side with Dave Tilley and some of our DPTs, as saying, you know, maybe some of the stretches and some of the other things that we've done in the gymnastics world might not be optimal in terms of bettering people's movement later down the road. So some of the shoulder stuff that we've just done in the gymnastics world, we've taken a closer look at and tried to be a little bit more understanding of how the shoulder works and what might be the real limitations in terms of people's extension and positional ability levels, whether that be T-spine or soft tissue of the underarm or, you know, soft tissue of pec, bicep tendon, anterior delt, all these things that, you know, sometimes we sometimes neglect and just do stretches because the previous generation did them. And we're trying to be a little bit more targeted and smarter with the way that we approach certain movements. And that's come from taking a step back, trying to apply a little bit more of the medical perspective in the way that we train. And I've definitely changed some of the approach that I've had with not only my own training, but also the way that I teach and the way that I work with my clients because of the incorporation of more of the medical perspective.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Awesome. And final question, is there any book or sort of a part two to that question, a quote as well, that is a favorite of yours that you would recommend to anyone?
Let's see. I mean, there's a bunch of quotes that I really kind of cling to and that I use on a regular basis. You know, one, just with Power Monkey, kind of our motto is that technique matters. I think that's a very simple approach to kind of how we approach things. Technique matters with every movement that you're doing. Kind of have it at the forefront of your mind. Another one that we have up in the Stanford gym that always resonated with me is take pride in the process. And to appreciate the baby steps that come along with the long journey towards higher level skills. And to understand that you're not going to go from point A to point Z in an afternoon. That every small incremental gain is something that should be celebrated. And you should take, you know, pride in the fact that you're able to make incremental gains and celebrate those as, on your way to something more significant. So take pride in the process is something that I always preach and that I'm really a firm believer in. And then lastly, another quote that I like is, how you do anything is how you do everything. And I saw this in a gym up on a wall years back, and I really believe that as well. I think it can kind of translate into other aspects of your life, not just in the way that you move or the way you approach a specific training session, but also how you live your life outside of the gym. And it can be extremely challenging, obviously, but it helps refocus a little bit when you're doing something that might seem like it's a non-issue, making your bed in the morning or washing the dishes, and taking a little bit more pride in kind of who you are as a person starts to translate into other areas of your life. So I've really tried to make a concerted effort to say, you know, if I'm going to put my time and energy to make my positions perfect in the gymnastics world and really be proud of the way that I move, let me see if I can translate that into other aspects of my life.
Mm. Yeah, that's awesome. Mm. Well, that's fantastic.
Okay, one book that I think I've read recently that can be really helpful, I think, for a lot of people. It's more from the business side of things, and having trying to run a business with Power Monkey that had a lot of really good nuggets and some powerful concepts in there was a book came out last year, I believe, called Principles by Ray Dalio.
Why did I think you were going to say that? I just knew you were going to say that somehow. I'm reading it at the moment. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a phenomenal book. I highly recommend, especially if you're, you know, an entrepreneur or someone that's trying to be in the business world, has a lot of great concepts that I think will be helpful.
Mm. Yeah, we say it all the time. We've reviewed it on the show before, but yeah, if you haven't picked up that book yet and you have a business, like, you need to slap yourself. It's one of the most thorough best, well laid out business books on the face of the planet, and you should have the audio and the physical version because you'll need to highlight the and take notes in the physical version.
Yeah,
but
you see what my copy is like. I have notes everywhere and highlights. It looks like one of my textbooks from college.
Yeah. No, it's great stuff. The Power Monkey journey is only beginning, I feel like. What is your hopes for it in the future, Dave? Obviously, besides coming to Sydney and doing a seminar at our gym.
the main goal is to bring good quality content and education to as many people as we possibly can around the world. And, you know, we do that a few different ways. I like to tell people that Power Monkey is based around three prongs. We have our education side, which is essentially our online programming and through our Monkey Method app, which people can find on iOS or on Android. We have our event side, which is through our clinics and our weekend seminars and our Power Monkey Camp. Power Monkey Camp is actually a big, big part of our business and what we do, and it's probably what most people recognize us for. Our week-long fitness camp that we host two times a year in Tennessee. And then our third prong is the equipment side. So the ring thing, which we talked about in the beginning of the podcast, and all the things that come along with that. We've created a certification program with the ring thing. We've created a class that we're really excited about that we announced a couple of weeks ago, and actually we're doing the first certification tomorrow and Saturday at Crunch Fitness here in New York, and they're going to be unveiling it at a few locations in New York and hopefully building it to other locations around the U.S. But that's a way for us to be able to bring gymnastics to people that didn't grow up with it. And with our apparatus, with our content, with our events, we can bring more technical understanding of gymnastics to more people around the world, and that's what we're hoping to do.
That's awesome. Yeah, cool. I recommend for anyone that doesn't have a ring thing and is teaching people gymnastics on the rings, there is no better tool to get them onto to learn than the ring thing.
Like, so much easier than standing there, taking part of their body weight.
It's incredible. And it's so easy to give people homework on the ring thing.
Yeah.
So easy to give it to them because they just strap in and they can do the full movement.
And it's fun. It's fun because you're doing muscle ups like everyone else is a bit earlier.
Oh, I can't tell you how many girls especially have gotten their first strict muscle up at our gym that have used the ring thing as an essential part. Like, I'd say almost all of them have used the ring thing as a part of their training. Like, they could not have done it without it. Or if they had, it would have taken a lot longer. So, yeah, it's an awesome
tool.
That's
what we want. Help people build and understand correct movement patterns. They can slowly start to add additional body weight to it. Correct movement patterns go such a long way in being able to apply it to something like a muscle up and beyond. But we do have a distributor in Australia. So if you guys are interested in listening from Australia, New Zealand, he's in Sydney. We can send over some information if you want to post along, but very easy to find him if you're interested in picking one up out there.
Yeah, awesome. Cool. Fantastic. Well, Dave, people can follow you on Instagram. I believe it's at Dave Durante, just one word. No spaces, right. No capitals, nothing like that. So, where else can we send people? Power Monkey, they got the website?
Yep, powermonkeyfitness.com, powermonkeycamp.com, both very easy. Our Instagram is powermonkeyfitness as well. We also have a Ring Thing specific Instagram account, Ring Thing Training. Posting really cool videos, cool training tools, a lot of our videos in terms of how the ring thing can be used in unique ways. So I highly recommend people checking that out as well.
Nice. Awesome. All right, Dave. Well, for us, it's been an honor to finally get you on, and I'm sure that hopefully we can bring the camp out here soon. We'll hopefully get enough of you guys on eventually that you can't help but say.
Someone will end up.
Say yes. Yeah. Someone will cave eventually. So, fun.
Let's make it happen.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, another amazing episode. Thank you so much to Dave from Power Monkey Fitness for coming on. Guys, we are actually going to be doing Dave's core program for the next year straight. We're going to try and do 365 days, 7 days a week, 15 minutes a day of core work. For me, it's been a personal weakness for a very long time. So follow us on Instagram, The Mind Muscle Project, if you don't already. And I will always keep you up to date, as usual, in the stories and in the main part. Trying to get that core strong because it is a massive, massive weakness for me. So I'm going to be adding that into the repertoire. And guys, if you want to follow the journey of 100 days chasing our goals, thetrainingjournalbook.com, you can join in with us. Black 30, that's going to get you 30% off when you check out for the next 24 hours as of the release of this podcast. And if you want the new apparel, themindmuscleproject.com/apparel black20, when you check out, that's going to get you 20% off the new apparel. That's going to be for pre-order only. So orders close 7 days from the release of this show. Awesome. And then, of course, activatednutrients.com, the top-up product for the over 50s and the grow-up product for our little ones. And you guys can use the code OFFERMMP, one word, when you check out. That's going to get you 20% off those products. And then finally, guys, beyondmacros.com. You can book in a free consultation with Matt and let him know that the podcast sent you when you get there and you sort out your nutrition. All right, guys, thanks so much, and we'll see you next week. Thank you, Project, for tuning in again to another episode of the My Muscle Project. We release an episode every single Monday. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, the My Muscle Project, to stay up to date with everything we're doing. And if you have some time, leave us a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes.
And don't forget, we have a second show of the week, The After Show. So it's no longer a rest day on Thursdays. If you have any questions for Lachlan and I for that show, head to themymuscleproject.com/theaftershow. And if you ask a question, we'll answer it on the show.
Thanks again so much, Project, and we'll see you all next week.